Hey, Grinders, welcome back to the Grind Daily Podcast. I'm Carson Sweezy, uncovering the hustle. Today, my guests are Eugene Davidson and Natalie Woke. They are house flippers in the greater DC area. We talk a lot about their processes and systems that they use to run a successful house flipping business. Yes, house flipping is what you see on the HGTV shows, but there's a lot more to it than that. It's not all glitz and glamour. There's quite a lot that goes into it, and they take a very analytical approach to not only analyzing deals, but the entire system from purchasing the house to renovating it to putting it back on the market and everything in between. It was a really interesting conversation. They have a lot more experience than either one of their ages might lead you to believe, and it certainly taught me a lot. I hope you enjoy. Here's the episode.
Natalie and Eugene, welcome to the podcast. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am doing great. I'm doing great. Really appreciate you guys coming on the show. So let's jump into it. I want to hear, I know you guys have a flipping business. What do you guys do with that flipping business?
Okay. So we buy, renovate, and resell homes. We do it largely in Prince George's County. We're now entering D.C. And we've been doing that for
about a year and a half.
Year and a half now. So we are on projects number five or six or seven at this point, as far as renovations. We've gotten some of the systems down. We've gotten some of the details down, and we're kind of just chugging along at this point.
Yeah, we did do one renovate to rent project up in Baltimore County, and that's currently rented and doing pretty good just now. Doing some to some for sale and some for rent.
Nice. So how did you guys get started in the business? What's some of your background?
So my background is in real estate. I took a job when I was 14, working as a receptionist in a Remax office. Because, the way showings used to be done is the agent would call in and schedule it with the listing broker. And every real estate office, and probably many of them still do, would have, receptionists who would work into the evening, so, a 3 to 9 p.m. shift. And I took this job, and I got fired after about 3 to 4 weeks or so. But I didn't make a very good receptionist. They said I wasn't nice enough on the phone. I don't know what's like. But I got hired by a broker. This is in Michigan. This is 2003, right before things really got bad in Michigan. And he was selling foreclosures. And we ended up selling together probably 3,500 foreclosures for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Through that, I learned how to inspect homes. I learned how brokerage works. I spent 9 or 10 years working for the guy, and we did a lot of really interesting things together. We started buying up properties and renting them out. And Michigan's a very cheap market, so you can learn pretty easily. It's the barrier to entry is pretty low. And as the market started to improve, we started flipping houses. So I had the privilege, and I will say this is the privilege of project managing, probably 24 flips in Michigan. And by being able to do that, I was able to learn other people's money, his money. So when we came out here, it wasn't immediately, but when we started, I already had some experience. I already knew some of the things to do and some of the things not to do. I understood what buyers looked for when they were walking through a house. Basically, an apprenticeship, almost decades-long apprenticeship that did me a lot of good. And so during that decade, a lot of other things happened. I met Natalie. We have been together 6 years now, just celebrated 2 years of marriage. And we invest together. We're more, husband and wife are also business partners. We don't buy houses unless both of us like them or are convinced that they're going to work. We don't make major decisions without each other, but that's kind of my background. But Natalie's path to this is very, very different from mine. And I think she should tell you about where she comes from and what she's done.
Yeah, I didn't really have much of a real estate background at all before meeting Eugene. I met Eugene while we were both in grad school. Both of us studied urban planning, actually, which wound up being a little helpful for the real estate business. And my first introduction to property management was, unfortunately, my mom passed away in 2012. And so my sister and I inherited her home in Michigan on the coast of Lake Michigan, beautiful little town, Ludington. You should go if you've never been. And so we had a vacation rental on our hands that we were then renting out for about, I think, two seasons, so maybe a year and a half. And so that was kind of my trial by fire into property management and getting into all of that. Yeah, and then shortly afterwards, Eugene and I moved to D.C. I started working for the federal government. A little ways down the line, we started up our business here. And I've been learning a lot from Eugene. And like he said, you know, we make all our buying decisions together. And so it's really great to have that sounding board for ideas, but also to kind of double check your math and to understand, you know, to have like another pair of eyes that you trust, looking at all the numbers and saying, okay, this is something that we're going to put our money where our mouth is on this one. So, yeah.
It's something like, you know, one of us, me maybe, might get really excited about a house, get ready to sign on the dotted line. We don't buy anything. That without both of us being on board. And I think that's somebody who's like a little, might, you're Natalie, and I get like one of you is going to get excited, the other one has to check the math, and when you kind of go back and forth, it's hard to do anything in this business without like passion or excitement. It really is, but also the other person like has to be the counter, and make sure that don't sell the farm.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like real estate. The math involved in real estate is not all that complicated, especially at the residential level. But it does help that both of us are coming at this from a more analytical background. You know, both of us study economics, and I also study math. And so I definitely approach something with where's the additional analysis? What more can we learn? What else is out there? Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Like to have the perspective of someone else that you can bounce things off of. What are some things, like, what's an example of something that came up? Was there anything like super crazy that one of you was really excited about and the other looked at it and was like, no, we can't buy this?
I think it's usually that Eugene will get excited about something. and then I'll say, well, you know, did you run it through our numbers? Did you run it through against, you know, can you send me the comps and all of that? But I mean, Eugene goes to see a lot more properties than me because I have a full-time job. So just by the very nature of that, there's a lot more to get excited about always.
Right.
Before you kind of sit down and, you know, think twice and three times and five times about actually going down that path.
Yeah. Like I'll take a cursory look at the comps. I'll run out, look at the house. I'll get really excited because I'm seeing that half the picture where I see how much the rehab is going to cost. Hmm. And then it's time to go back home and rerun the numbers because now you have a potential deal. And that's where, you know, and sometimes it kills a lot of excitement. Like a lot of things look really promising when you're standing inside the house and then they kind of fall apart. And the one thing I'll talk about is we look at a lot of houses. One of my biggest pet peeves, and this is mentioned like on Bigger Pockets all the time, is guys who are like, I can't find a deal. We look at houses every single day. You know, if there's even the slightest chance that we're going to end up buying the thing or it has some potential as a deal, we're out there. We're looking at it. And, you know, we put a lot of miles on our car. And I think it's just such a funny thing that, like, we're like, can't find a deal. Well, you're probably not looking at enough of them because we haven't really struggled that much with finding deals because we're constantly doing it. It doesn't stop. And no matter how many projects we have going on, if something comes across my desk, we're getting in the car and we're going, and that's just what it is.
Yeah. I mean, we also don't just look at potential deals. We also like to look at some finished products maybe in the neighborhood that we're targeting, just because, I mean, Eugene will say this to anybody who listens, that you'll learn something every single time you walk through a house. Because, you know, homes have endless configurations and endless problems and kind of endless options for how you deal with those problems. And so it's good to, we definitely learn something just by taking a look at what the competition is doing in the neighborhood as well.
Awesome. Awesome. So, I love that basically what Eugene's saying is you guys just have to hustle to find a deal, right? I mean, it comes down to hustling. And then what Natalie's saying is like, the process does make sense too. Like, you have to do analysis and you have to put in hard work. I mean, you guys are both talking about hard work and grinding. Like, you can't just go out and find a deal. You might be able to in Craigslist in some market and it might be a great deal, but you still want to do your analysis and figure out if the numbers make sense and do homework outside of that one house, right? So what's kind of, what's the process that you guys use for like identifying if this is a good deal? Just not like the specific formulas or anything, but kind of a rundown. Do you have like a checklist that you go off of?
We have a basic investment calculator. You can get this anywhere online, but the simpler usually is the better. So that, like, you really don't want to limit yourself at the beginning of your search. You really want to keep your eyes open. So don't have a super specific calculator that you run your deals through so that only produces like one deal a month. So you don't really want to do that. But have an investment calculator. My goal on the flip is there has to be a rehab comp in the neighborhood over the last year or so. So somebody has – that's the beautiful part about real estate is mostly you can make money following the guy who really took the major risk. So if you see a rehab comp in the neighborhood, that's usually your best start. One thing that I'll throw a little hint, if you're going to go into a neighborhood, you're going to look at the project that you're considering buying, drive by the one that's been rehabbed and see if they're actually comparable. You're going to learn a lot just by, you know, standing outside of the thing. You're already in the neighborhood. It's things that, you know, talk to the neighbors. You can really maximize your time when you go out and you look at properties when you're out there grinding. And the things that neighbors will tell you is just amazing. If only you'll listen. The things, you know, the little hints they'll tell you about who else is selling, which house you should go door, you know, knock on the door of. I mean, it's mind-blowing. And I see it all the time. Guys pull up, they run through the house, they run to the back, they get in the car, they go back home, and you're already in the neighborhood, you know? It's
like, yeah, get as much information as you can while you're out there, right?
A lot of it is, you know, you do your research and you do your numbers, and there's a list of stuff that we can solve for that become the knowns. And there's a list of stuff that we can't solve for that are obviously the unknowns. You try to minimize your list of unknowns. No house that we buy, do we know everything about it? We'll get inspections, and you know they don't find everything. That's just the truth of it. Inspectors don't find everything, but you want to minimize your list of unknowns and you want to minimize your risk, but accept that there's going to be some risk in what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things you do to minimize risk is, I didn't know this, but you find a neighborhood or you look for places that someone's already done a rehab and you're taking the risk of, is this flip going to sell or is this rehab going to sell, basically. I think that's really smart. That's really smart.
Yeah, if there's no comps in the neighborhood, then we're not going to bank on being able to push that top sales price in the neighborhood. We'll go someplace where, you know, maybe the best comp is going to be like, I think that, you know, some people use a baseball analogy with flipping. You know, it might be a single, might be a double, might be a home run, but we're always looking for something where if we can, say with confidence that, okay, we're definitely going to get a single on this one, we'll probably just go for it. And then if it winds up being something better than that, it's just gravy on top.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So you guys are finding deals on the market or you're off the market or a mixture of both?
We've had a real mixture this year. I've been surprised. You know, I used to hear guys talk about off market deals and like, is anybody really doing these things? half of what we bought this year has been off market. through, you know, I have some banking relationships and wholesalers I've met. We bought one off of like a meetup news list, you know, like the how like meetup.com like sends out, you know, people go back and forth. I read that thing, and it's like there's a lot of, we find contractors on there. And then we also have bought off the MLS, and that helps. And I'll throw this out there, and I know people can take this advice. You're not really a serious investor if you're not licensed and you don't have access to the MLS. Like I have a lot of trouble taking you seriously because our MLS here is so powerful.
And what region are you guys in? You guys are operating in the DC area?
Yeah, DC area.
You do anything in like Baltimore?
The DC area. Yeah, we'll go up to Baltimore County. We're hoping to get more rentals up there. We have one right now. I'd love to get more. But I will say, if real estate investing is your thing, look at getting licensed or somehow getting access to the MLS. The statistical tools are just, they're massive.
So for like pulling comps alone and stuff like that, for anyone that's listening, comps, just comparable properties that are going to give you a good idea of how much the house is going to sell for because it's a comparable property. And we can talk about that. I can try to fill people in later, but what are some other tools that you might have? Like, so if you're a licensed professional that helps get statistical information, what are other tools or other partners that you might leverage, like contractors and stuff like that?
Yeah. So it's a relationship business. We've spent a lot of effort building relationships in this business, building with contractors, with title companies, with attorneys. And we spent a lot of effort not burning those bridges, paying invoices when they come in. I don't know how many. If you don't pay an invoice in this business, it will come back to you. If you don't pay a commission when a commission is owed, or a wholesale fee when a wholesale fee is owed, there are a million ways to rip off a vendor in this business. And I don't know how to repeat this clearly enough. Pay your people, and those relationships will have done so much for us. The people who will just call us and say, "Hey, you really need to go look at this house," because they, without knowing that, without having anything in writing with us, know that they're going to get paid. I can't reinforce that enough. And you know, we just like run our business on doing the right thing. And if we're not sure what to do, we say, "Hey, what's the right thing to do?"
And if we can't afford to pay somebody, then we don't enter the deal because we're going to honor whatever deal that we made. I mean, it's as simple as that.
It's like the more maximized idea of like, if you can't afford to tip the waiter, then like don't go out to eat.
Exactly.
Like, why would you go spend $30 on a meal and then you can't even tip the guy? Then maybe you shouldn't be out there eating, you know?
Maybe you should have Carson teach you how to cook.
Yeah, there you go. I really like that's really sound principle. And And especially in real estate, I mean, there's some shady things that go on, would you say, Eugene? So having just sound principles and being, even if you're the only guy in the market that's honest and people know you're going to pay them, that gives you an upper hand with finding deals and stuff, like you're saying. So
it's amazing. And what I've seen through, we've gotten really into networking over the last couple of years. And what I've seen is, as you build relationships with people, it's a very small world. And what I find amazing is that somebody will rip off somebody in the same networking group because
or
not paying invoices. And sometimes it's funny because it's like a few hundred dollars and I'm like, are you kidding? Like, you've spent hours building these relationships and putting yourself out there as a professional in this group, and you're going to... I mean, it's really funny what you see, but it's also really sad, and it makes it. We're not in this business to be in this for like 3 months. The average timeline of a flip stuff takes three or four months, but we're in this for years, and I think a lot of people forget, especially in the beginning, that this is a long race. This is not a sprint.
That's really, I'm glad you talked about that. Cause besides just like ethically trying to be a good person, You should also be incentivized by your business, right? Like, your business will do better if you're a good person.
I'm hoping we're all going to be here next year, right?
Right. Depending on what happens in the election, we'll all be here next year. But we try not to talk about that. I want to get back to the flips, though, because I'm certainly interested in learning more about the process, and I think our listeners will be, too. So you find these deals on the market or off the market, and you're saying it helps to have your license because you can maybe find more deals and have access to it quicker and have statistical information so you can calculate things quicker. Once you get the deal and you've analyzed it and it's gone through your calculators, what's the next step? Do you write a contract right away, or do you have contractors come out and give you estimates, or how do you go about moving along?
For the most part, at that point, we will write our contract. I will have a contractor come out if there's something I'm not sure about, some issue I haven't seen before, also settling in a weird way that I don't understand. There are some red flags where I start to think I need another pair of eyes. And now we'll talk about that and we'll say, hey, listen. But I do suggest getting something under contract, or at least getting that conversation going with the seller so that you're not wasting anybody's time. You don't want to waste the seller's time, and you definitely don't want to waste your contractor's or your inspector's time. You know,
especially while he's still working on your other jobs.
I mean, these things, like, as you have people who are working for you, you'll get some freebies. Like, they'll say, oh, yeah, Eugene, I'll go look at this house if you need me to, or I'll do this, I'll do that for you. Value that, because those are gifts, and you need to, you need to play them when you actually need them and not just, for the hell of it.
Okay, actually, I want to talk about mentorship, because we talked about it a little bit earlier with what you were doing in Michigan. You were project managing, and so how much of that was like you learning on the job by doing, and how much of it was just working with someone else and them kind of teaching you stuff?
I think what was interesting is I learned a lot of the practical things, but a lot of my job was building out the systems of what it takes to scale. So the first thing you have to do is you have to do a flip. I mean, you actually have to do a flip from start to finish before you can start building out your systems and have these ideas and have all these Excel spreadsheets. I know I'm a big spreadsheets guy, and we're a Podio platform and all this stuff, but you have to actually do a project from start to finish, just like any other real estate deal. And that's something I got to learn how to do. But the really cool part that I was part of is we went from doing one flip at a time to doing, I think, 5 or 7 at a time. And if you want to do that sort of volume, that's where you start building out your systems. That's where you start building out your checklists and your spreadsheets. And I did a lot of that. And that's the part that I think I learned how to do kind of on my own. But the part that I was taught was the actual nuts and bolts of how a renovation works and how to manage your contractor and what the thing needs to look like when it's done. And sound business practices. And I think that's something that's missing. You work with an organization that's run well, and you start building upon that organization. Yes, you're being mentored, but you don't really understand how much of that value is that you're working within something that somebody already built for you. I took every opportunity I could when I worked for Marshall was to be in the car and to inspect homes with him, and to work on the deals. I mean, every opportunity I said, hey, how do I help you with this? How would I help you with that? Was a way for me to learn and kind of be a sponge, because I knew that eventually I'd be doing this on my own. I mean, I kind of figured that path was run its course, and just like any apprenticeships, you're out there doing your own. I made sure I was always delivering value, but you've got to take an active interest in your education and in the work you're doing. If what you're trying to do is eventually build something on your own, some version of the thing that's happening where you work today, you've got to be proactive. I worked with a lot of great people there, but I think I was the only one who was really interested in one day doing this on my own. And if you take that interest, if you take that initiative, it pays off. It pays off a lot. I don't really think that anybody's ever going to approach you and say, hey, I want to mentor you. That really is, I haven't heard that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's happened to you, Carl. It hasn't really, nobody's ever approached me and said, hey, listen, Eugene, I want to teach you how to do this. But what I will say, and I'll throw out another hint, guys who are like years ahead of Natalie and I, right, have businesses that are, they're doing 50, 100 deals, they will happily have coffee with you. And if you ask them a question, they'll answer you honestly. They might not give you their secret sauce. If you tell them what you're doing, they'll probably tell you, well, actually, Eugene, that's not a great idea.
Right. Yeah, I mean, people love giving like, young people advice.
Yeah, and people will tell you. And guys who are 100 steps ahead of you in the process. And I say guys because it is a very male-oriented business. Natalie is changing that. But it's like a very dude, bro-y, fratty business. I'll happily admit that. But people will be so generous with their time. So it's so incredibly generous. And this is something whenever somebody reaches out to me, I can't help but give back. I love talking about this stuff. I won't shut up. The amount that other investors will do for you is really amazing. The only thing I'd say is, like, will somebody one day steal one of your deals? Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get a little too open with somebody and you tell them exactly the address, somebody might steal a deal from you. That you know, it's still a very competitive business. It's a competitive sport. But I will say people have been incredibly helpful. And the amount of stuff that we've done for free, the amount of knowledge we've done for free, that we never had to rely on a guru or a rich dad at seminar.
Just learning by doing.
No, there is nothing I was going to add.
Okay. Yeah. Natalie, can I ask you, so for any female that would be listening, and Eugene's say there's a lot of dudes in real estate, which there definitely are in the investing side, what would you tell someone that's young and wanting to get starting in flipping or a real estate business as a female? What would you tell them, like, piece of advice? Or what's a challenge that you've come across that you might have seen?
Well, okay, I guess I'll answer your first question first. I'd say... I think this advice, you know, that Eugene is mentioning, I think would be equally applicable to you know, both men and women. But as
right.
far as challenges go, I think the only challenge that we've encountered in the past with some contractors that we no longer work with is that we found that during project management, this particular floor contractor was a little less responsive to me, or maybe didn't buy into my authority as much as when. And so we kind of got to this point where if I directed the contractor to do something or was, you know, trying to negotiate with him on something, it started to become less effective. Eventually, I just said, you just deal with him and so that was, I think, a loss. But ultimately, we had a lot of other issues with this particular.
We should have fired him.
We should have fired him.
And that would have saved us a lot of pain. And
that's a red flag.
It is a red flag. You know, and it is a red flag that they're not willing to respect the authority of one of the business partners. So that should have been, if we had fired him then, that would have saved us a massive headache and a lot of money. And so that would be my advice.
Awesome. Well, I mean, that's really helpful because I've come across, I'm a dude, but I've come across like sexist contractors. There's definitely a lot, for whatever reason, the contractor industry seems to attract people that just haven't caught up with the times or something. I don't know, but they have authoritarian issues with anyone who's not like them, I think, or what they're quote unquote like used to working with or whatever. But you seem to have, no offense, Eugene, but the more authoritative role in the business. Is that accurate, or am I?
I will say that I am not as involved in project management anymore, in particular, just because I have a full-time job. And so Eugene is on site a lot more than I am. But I am involved a little bit.
Design does not, design and spec list is, has nothing to do with me at all.
Actually, that's true. Yeah. So I make all the design decisions for, I'm kind of the final say on exactly what goes in, what materials go in, layout and all of that. So I'm involved in that aspect of the project management, not necessarily, like keeping everybody on time and all of that. Or with payments.
But it's Natalie's plan that I execute on. If that makes sense at all. Like,
yeah, it does.
And I think, and our contractors know that. And you know, the finished product. I don't have an eye for design. This is something that's very clear. If you've ever seen anything that I've built, it's not my strong suit, and that's okay. There are things I excel at, design, and making it look like a home. It's never going to be. I'm just not that guy. And I have some ideas, like, you know, the work triangle. If anybody wants to Google the work triangle, like, oh, okay, dishwasher on the right. And, you know, but, you know, we're executing on Natalie's plan.
I think that's important. You mentioned, like, you're not that guy that's going to do that. And it's important to know like what you're good at and what you're not good at, or what you want to do and what you just don't feel comfortable doing. How do you guys delegate roles within your partnership?
I get to do all the fun stuff.
Fun stuff that I would find miserable, by the way.
Perfect example. There you go.
I'd say that we are, when it comes to making buying decisions and evaluating deals, I'd say that we kind of duplicate the work, because we need to have that extra layer of check. Like, you need to come up with your independent analysis of is this going to work, and I'll do the same. We're not just going to pin it on the other person. Oh, well, you decided to buy this house. It doesn't work like that. And then I guess, yeah, and as Eugene mentioned, I guess the design of the house and the scope of work. So that ultimately manifests in the scope of work and spec list. And then also making any additional design decisions that need to get made along the way, or how are we going to resolve this thing that came up? And I do a lot of research to figure out how to do that, since I don't have any professional training as a designer or architect. I also do the pictures
and staging
and the staging. Yeah.
And then we make sell decisions together. Nothing gets bought or sold out until rented, until we're both on board and we're both comfortable that this has a good probability of leading to success. By the way, I will throw this out there. If you're going to flip and you don't know what a spec list is or a scope of work list is, you need to stop right now. I really didn't understand this, but if you don't have a spec list and a scope of work, you really can't do this. There are a lot of things you can do wrong, that this is one thing you really can't skip over. If you don't know what every room in the house is going to look like, and it's not on paper and in glorious detail, which is something Natalie does a lot of, stop. Please just stop. Just go back and Google spec list and Google scope of work and look at some examples. We spent hours in the house figuring out what it's going to look like. And having an idea of where you're headed is so important. It is just so critical. And I don't think I didn't really love the paperwork and the systems before we got into this, but now
they're the fundamentals of how we do business. Yeah. And so they are absolutely critical to the work that we do. And not having a scope of work that you know that you're comfortable using and that is customized to the level of renovation that you're going to do, and also the spec list, not having those two documents for the first time that you do the flip is part of what makes your very first one so hard, because you're kind of starting from scratch and you don't have these templates to start from. And those two documents have certainly gotten better, progressively better every single time we have a flip and something comes up during work and it says, oh, well, that wasn't on the scope of work. we said, well, let's go back to that and make sure that that's in there for the next time around. And we're constantly, those two documents are kind of living documents, not for any one particular job, but, you know, lessons learned for the next one. We'll incorporate that into, you know, those core documents.
So constantly refining the process as you go and not being like stubborn on doing that, right? Sometimes I have an issue of like wanting to get the whole process lined up in the beginning. And every time I do that, I realize that it like kind of holds you back a little bit. And at some point you just have to jump in and have a good idea of what your processes are, but then continually refine them along the way with whatever it is you're doing. So it's cool that you guys do that. You gotta take the punches as they come. And there's a lot of punches in real estate. In terms of like the process of flipping, what's the next step after you put the contract in and you've got it accepted by the seller and you're like after the closing? We won't talk about closing on the purchase of it, but what's next after you've closed on it and you're ready to go?
We've usually met with our contractor there. We've completed an inspection. An inspection gives us kind of a more detailed list of things that, you know, we might have missed when we walked through the house. We complete our spec list and our scope of work, and we schedule our contractor. We use a general contractor, so he handles a lot of stuff, and we're on site about 3 or 4 times a week to make sure things are moving along, to make sure that he's executing on the design. And we generally expect about $1,000 of work to be done on a daily basis. Which is basically industry standard for residential construction. And as he does work, we pay him out. So quickly, how we do payment is we give the contractor a little bit of money up front. We give about $3,000. And as he finishes line items, we pay him 70% of that line item. And then at the end, he's owed usually somewhere around
25% of contract value.
Is at the end. And that's worked out pretty well for us. So one thing we will do is we tell contractors, the moment you finish something and it's right and it's legal, we'll pay you for it. We'll pay you 70% of the value. So all you have to do is call us. And generally every Friday, we write checks. But that's, you know, checking the work as it's done. Nothing should be a surprise at the end of the project because you've been at this house, you know, 20 or 30 times by then. And at the end, we pay the guy. We stage and
take photos,
and we list.
Yeah. I think that one thing that has worked really well for us with the payment schedule is I feel like that it can be a central point of tension whenever you're working with contractors is payment schedule. And kind of needing more money to keep working or, you know, all of that. So if you have a crystal clear payment schedule that's outlined, all of this is explained in the scope of work. And then once they, you know, start experiencing it in practice, then it becomes it kind of eliminates a lot of that tension, I think, because it's clear. We say, look, you complete work and you'll get more checks. As opposed to it being not clear exactly when they're going to get paid or and all of that.
Yeah, and you build trust with contractors over many projects where they see that you pay your bills, and that makes it a lot less stressful. Contracting the general contracting job it's hard, and it's hard on their cash flows, and we're sensitive to that. But at the same time, we don't provide interest-free loans to them, and they don't provide interest-free loans to us. So as they complete work, we pay them. But until work is done, we don't pay. And nobody's getting massive draws. You know, I've heard systems out there of like a third, a third, a third. So a third of the contract up front, a third in the middle, a third at the end. And your contractor might be $50,000 or $100,000 ahead of you. And that's not a good position for anybody to be in.
Or the other way around, and then you're putting a strain on their resources. So far we have felt that this is the best system for us.
Yeah. But I was strongly suggesting, you know, a lot of investors use their contractors as banks. I strongly suggest against that. You want to keep these people in business. You want to keep them happy. But don't I wouldn't suggest letting yourself be used as a bank either. That's probably not a good way to work. And these are, you know, these are common practices. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, so lots of businesses have payment schedules and payment practices that mirror pretty well what we do. You know, pay as you go method.
Yeah, and that's pretty important. So I mean, beyond your experience in Michigan, you guys just do a lot of research, it sounds like, and figure out like how the best way to refine the process is. You're not just relying on coming up with everything yourself. You're leveraging what other people have done in their successful businesses. And I think that's really important for definitely people younger getting started, just leverage assets that have matured more. I mean, get some experience. And somehow, Eugene, you seem to have like 20 years of real estate experience, and I'm pretty sure you're still in your 20s. So I don't know how that's happened.
Start young.
That's really cool though. So you guys are married. You said you've been married. Congrats on the anniversary. Forgot to tell you earlier. Right. But what challenges have you come across just as business partners in general? Knowing each other as friends, or I mean, just generally like having known each other in a non-business setting first, and then transitioning into a business partnership. What challenges have you faced in that light?
I think one of the challenges, and I don't think that this is necessarily unique to us being business partners, but well, maybe it is. I think one of the challenges is just that since we spend a lot of time together, it's kind of like any time is a candidate for work time. But I think that we enjoy a lot of the real estate business work that we do, especially while we're together, because a lot of it is either, you know, shopping for deals, or I mean, that's a lot of it. Yeah. Or it may just be discussing, you know, kind of progress on what's going on with one of the houses. I guess that, yeah, there's always that opportunity for the work to bleed over into our personal time, I guess. But since we enjoy it, it's kind of all the same to us.
Wow, that's cool. Like enjoying what you do, that might give more incentives than someone who's like trying to force a business, right? I've known friends, and I like hear about friends a lot that go into business together, and sometimes they really want to start a business, right? And as young people, and there's a lot of stuff we see on social media and in the news about, you know, like the 20-year-old founder of a company or whatever, and it's pushing people more and more to really want to start businesses earlier. And I think sometimes it can make you start something that you're not even really that interested in. You're more interested in starting the business than the business that you're starting, right? So doing what you like and having a really profound interest in what you're doing is a really easy way to motivate yourself.
It is, but I will tell you, the first year or two of any business are going to suck. I mean, you can love it. I mean, you might be out there grooming dogs. You're probably not going to be very happy. Speaking of dogs, mine is barking, forgive
me. Heard you talking about the species.
Except that, and also it's really hard to like something that you're not good at yet, and that you're still growing, and you're uncomfortable, and, you know, and you're not sure you're making progress. Those aren't really going to be very fun days. And I think we've had some really not fun days, and and the business can be enjoyable, can have a lot of things, but I think it'll get more enjoyable the better we get at it, and the more we know, and the more you see the growth, that's where it gets really enjoyable and fun. I think I really worry about people who think that it's going to be fun on day one, and I know you grind daily, Carson. I'm guessing there's days that aren't a whole lot of fun, and that's don't expect it to pay dividends immediately. It's just not going to do that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's I think it goes back in part to like the mentorship thing, like having some good knowledge about what you're getting into, but also just, I mean, any business and anything you do has headaches, and you have to somehow leverage it as a learning curve and something you're going to be better at next time. Right. Just like you guys change your spec list every time. Yep. You're just always learning. You're constantly learning, right?
Try to embrace that. One book I'd really recommend is The Growth Mindset by Carol Dweck. I know it's out there, but it's been butchered and all that. But the whole idea of like seeing things and the idea that you can learn how to do them rather than you start something and you're like, oh, I'm not any good at it. Well, you're not good at it because you haven't, you haven't put in the work yet. And that's, I think I see a lot of people struggling because they expect to be good at this real estate thing on day one. And it takes time. It takes, gotta put in those days.
Nice.
It's all sunshine and rainbows.
No, I'm just thinking, I mean, I think that probably the most stressful time of any flip is the day that we list it for sale. I think that is always a stressful time because everything leading up to that, it's kind of like, oh, we can still, or, we still have a lot of influence, a great deal of influence over what's happening and kind of how the finished product is going to turn out. But then once we list, there's not much for us to do but wait and hope that somebody out there will validate all of our analysis and all of the hard work and money that we've put into this property over the last several months.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other job, right? Like listing homes.
Yeah. So I would say that is probably my least favorite part of the whole process. I enjoy the staging and photography, but once we list and it can be stressful, and even once you're under contract, you kind of like can't count on it until it's closed. And, there's plenty of properties that, have not been able to close and all of that, of course. Yeah,
I think that's a really important thing. And Eugene might have some stuff to say about that as an agent. Yeah.
I mean, as any entrepreneur knows, at some point you've got to launch. Like you've got to take this thing that you've been building and babying, and you've got to put it out into the world. And the world might not, might not love what you did.
It might not appreciate your baby,
And then that's always a risk. And if you don't want to deal with that risk, you should probably keep your day job. that's kind of all it is. You put your product out there, and you you sell it, and that's what it is. And if you don't want to deal with the criticism or the people who who don't like it, we only need one buyer and deal with the criticism. And I think a lot of people forget that you want to make your project so it appeals to a lot of people, but at the end of the day, only one family is going to buy the thing, and you want as high of a probability as possible that you're going to be able to sell. You're going to be able to find that one family that's going to buy the home at your exit price. That's the science of the whole thing.
What are some of the benefits of having your license? Like once you're beyond the flip side of it, once you've already done the analysis and all that kind of stuff, like putting it back on the market, what advantages do you have as a licensed agent that's flipping your house and selling your house?
So I do have the option of listing it myself. And, I think a lot of people forget that this isn't free money. I could come in and say, oh, yeah, Carson, I save so much commission by listing the house myself. I do that job. Like, I represent the company, and I'm the one reviewing contracts, and I'm the one, it's basically taking on another role. And it's a way to increase the amount of revenue that that deal produces, but I will caution people that it's work. Real estate agents get paid to list homes for the work that they do. If you want to list your own property, that's fine. There are lots of reasons not to list your own property and to have somebody you trust, and lots of other investors have other people list their properties even if they are licensed. But I would caution people against thinking that they're quote unquote saving the commission.
Right. It's not like we get it under contract and then Eugene kicks up his feet. I mean, he's quarterbacking the sale the entire step of the way, every day, kind of checking in with what's going on and making sure that it's progressing.
Right. I mean, that's like another job all to itself. I mean, some people only list homes for their life. Like, that's what they do for their living. And you guys are flipping the home, buying the home, and listing the home. It's like another job on top of it, right?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that will go on forever. Some of these things will obviously become, will end up being staffed out. And right now we can kind of handle it in-house, but that might not last forever. But that stuff, you can increase the revenue of a deal by doing more and more of the work yourself. I mean, if we wanted to, I guess we could be out there with a hammer and nails and be our own general contractor.
No, we couldn't, Eugene.
But the one thing I will, it's now kind of touched on, is somebody has to drive. Somebody has to drive the transaction. And I have it's a really hard thing to explain to people, but I'm going to try. I see a lot of transactions out there where nobody's in charge, where there are all these parties and they're kind of hoping that it's just going to show up, that everybody's going to show up to closing on the settlement day. Somebody has to say, hey, is this here? Is this here? Where are we going to next? And I do take on that role, and I enjoy it a lot in closing these out. But I see a lot of transactions, especially where it's inexperienced agents trying to be their own agent, where they really don't know what's going on with their transaction because they haven't done enough deals to see all the things that could go wrong. I will say that if you are going to list your own home, they say a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. Just be careful.
Know what you're getting yourself into, and it might be more headache than what it's worth, right?
Yeah. Just because your license doesn't mean you have the skill set. And I apologize if that sounds like my ego talking, but yeah, just because the state gave you a license to do something doesn't mean you've developed the skill set to actually do it. Not that any of this is rocket science, but you still have to develop the skill set. That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and it's not like you just did this. I mean, you did it for 10 years or so in Michigan. So I think mentorship is so crucial, and I've learned a lot about definitely probably could have listed some homes by myself, but I wouldn't have done as good of a job as now that I have people that have done it for a while and can help. Yeah. Can help just anything that comes up. There's like a million things that come up in a real estate deal. And it's good to have that sounding board like you guys have talked about. They can steer you clear of certain situations and steer you in the right direction on other occasions, or just give you helpful advice, you know? Well, who do you guys seek out for advice? Is it just each other, or do you have others that you talk to?
So I can still seek out my mentor in Michigan. I have some investors that I'm really close with, people I can call and run numbers by. I will also seek out I'm licensed at Custom Realty. Liz North there is very experienced. She's an investor herself. She'll have some idea what's going on with our deals. But I am not fearful at all of picking up the phone and calling others in the market who are doing what we're doing and seeing if these numbers actually make sense. We have a great CPA. As you get into the taxation can get a little complex. I will suggest that you get a professional CPA. If you're doing more than a couple deals a year, you really shouldn't be doing TurboTax. There are little things you don't know. For example, the state of Maryland, if you flip a house and you're an out-of-state entity, they're a little concerned that you're going to take your earnings and not pay them tax. So they're going to hold on to them for a little while, just in case. And, it's cute until, you see that line item on your closing statement. Wait, dude, I thought I was getting all this money. Well, not so fast, Eugene. And there's you don't know what you don't know. The amount of value that you get from somebody who's a good CPA or a good broker or a good attorney, those people might charge you for 15 minutes of their time talking to you and deliver 40 years of knowledge. along with a bill for like $20. You know, there's a lot of people who will spend a lot of time with you. Our go-tos are definitely other investors, other brokers. Oh, the one thing I will talk about is if you're going into a neighborhood you don't know and you see that, you know, 4 of the 5 sales last year were done by, you know, Joe Smith, your next thought should be, I'm going to call Joe Smith. And this is like, if he laughs at you and says that's a really stupid idea, you should probably think twice because, you know, you're in the guy's backyard, you know. Understand that there are probably already people in your market that are doing what you want to do or understand the product better than you do. And you can call them and they'll tell you that. One thing we'll do is if we're selling a property and I see that somebody sold the property for top dollar, I'll call them and I'll say, hey, what happened here? How many offers did you have? Great. You know, did you have any problems on appraisal? Great. You know, and they'll tell you so much. People will pick up the phone and they'll be like, and, you know, and it's because people are generally nice and they'll tell you things. I see so many lone wolves out there trying to do their own thing. And it's sad because it makes it a lot harder.
That's what I really like about real estate is even in the residential side, when you're just doing regular buy and sells, you can just call up agents and just get some advice for your client. You know, I mean, if your buyer's looking in some neighborhood you don't really know, call the last 10 recent sales and talk to the people and try to see what the market was like. And people are very willing to give out that information, and it helps the industry, it helps consumers, it helps you, it helps them because they feel like they're getting validated almost. I mean, it's a win-win all around when people communicate with each other.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. I think it's very smart to have figured that out too. That the other thing that I will say is it's a very small world. The amount of people in any market, and this is a very busy market, who are actually doing deals. You know, there might be 100,000 agents in this market. Maybe 1% of them are consistently doing transactions. And so understand that if you're becoming one of the people in this market that is doing deals, the resources out there, and it's a very small world. That's something I'm trying to convey. So be nice to those people. And the reason they're being nice to you is a lot of them realize that, you know, you're one of only a few people who are actually doing deals in this market. And the likelihood that you're going to come across the same people over and over again is very, very high. Just because there's the churn in real estate, but there's a very small amount of people who consistently do deals year in and year out.
Interesting. Is there anything else that you guys want to talk about? Because I think, I mean, we've gotten some really good stuff, but I want to ask you guys if there's anything that you'd want to touch on before we move to the hustle round.
The one thing I will talk about is really quickly our resources, the stuff that's out there. There's no excuse for not taking advantage of bigger pockets. There's no excuse for not taking advantage of the amount of books in your library that you can pick up, the ebooks, the audiobooks. We're constantly reading, constantly trying to get smarter and trying to move this thing forward. Mm. And there is no reason to pay $40,000 to a guru. It makes me so sad. I meet somebody at almost every meetup I go to. I'm sure you do too, Carson, that people who spend all this money on paid education when they could have gotten it for 45 cents and overdue library fine.
Yep.
Thanks, Goodwill. Thanks.
Yeah, you might need to quote that.
And a lot of it free on BiggerPockets. BiggerPockets is an amazing resource. For anyone that doesn't know, it's basically like LinkedIn and Facebook of real estate investors. So it's social media, but it's also just a wealth of knowledge with resources, including blogs and there's an incredible forum that people can ask questions to experts on and get some really good answers, and their podcasts and all kinds of stuff. That's where I got started. I mean, before I even got licensed, just on BiggerPockets, learning from free advice. And I'm not trying to give them a shout out here, but I have to, because I just love their business practice and their whole concept. They give out so much free content to all their users, from their podcasts to their ebooks to all that stuff. And I just really like people then provide that value, and then you're more inclined to want to do something with them, right? When you're providing value.
Yeah. I guess that just echoing off of what Eugene just said as well, I'll say that, you know, for the first time that we flipped a house with our own money on the line, our mantra throughout the entire thing was just, all right, let's just not break money, or let's just not lose money, or let's try not to lose money. But even if we do, we're going to keep doing this. I guess the rationale behind that is that if you're contemplating dropping tens of thousands of dollars on, you know, formal education and this stuff, that is a lot of wiggle room. If you just were to get out there and to, you know, kind of using what, you know, scant things you picked up, even just from the internet, and you want to attempt to flip your first house, that's a good amount of wiggle room to work with. So you'd be better off just losing that and getting really badly burned on your first flip, and then taking everything that you just learned and then putting it into the next one, because there's no substitute for the experience of doing this stuff. And there are plenty of things that we read online or had heard from other people, and it still just went in one ear and out the other until we learned it ourselves and got burned doing it. And then we said, oh, okay, so this one really matters. Like, we should really do this. So yeah, the experience is powerful.
I really like that point. Learning if you're losing money that way, you're paying for your education in another way. You're paying in a more practical sense of having done it yourself, and you're going to learn a lot better than sitting in a seminar at a hotel conference or whatever with that guy from out of town that's telling you how to wholesale or whatever those gurus talk about. Who knows? But that's really cool. You guys didn't run into that, did you, with what you were doing, or did you pay some hard lessons in the beginning?
We made money on our first flip. It wasn't, looking back, if you were to calculate the hourly rate of all the extra work and time we had to put into the thing, it would have been pitiful. So yeah, we definitely lost some money maybe on our first flip because of mistakes that we made. And I think that we were able to still save ourselves a lot of those headaches because of the decade of experience that Eugene had been able to get in this field before we got into it on our own.
Nice.
But you know, the one thing I think everybody's, don't try to get rich on your first project. The idea is to just get through the damn thing. And try to build some confidence and understand that you're going to learn things, and you know it's not going to be perfect. The idea is to get through it, to put out a good product, and to move on to the next deal. I think I see a lot of people trying to really, you know, rake it in on that first deal, and either they don't get a deal at all because the profits they're looking for are so massive, or the thing kind of, you know, falls apart. The only thing I really like about flipping is you own the house. There's only one path out of this thing, and that's in my mind is, you know, once we own it, we're not thinking you're committed, and that's what I really like about this.
All the commitment is up front, and it's like you're in it.
There's no backing out once you've bought the house.
You've bought the house, you're rehabbing it, you just need to get that thing done, get it right, and get it sold and move on to the next project. And I do like that there's a lot of like flim-flam out there, like, oh, maybe I'll do this today, or maybe I'll do that. No, you're flipping a house. Like, that's what you're doing today. And you do that every day until you sell the damn thing. You know?
Nice. That's awesome. Having it, it gives you the end goal.
Yeah, there's really no flip-flopping on it. You signed up for this, so get it done.
I found real estate to be really good learning about, like, business in general. It's a good way, like, entry into entrepreneurship. You find that to be true, like, almost like training wheels for any other kind of business?
I do a little bit. The one thing I'll say is there's – You're almost buying a franchise, to be honest. When you buy a house to flip, you're doing something that I'm guessing millions of people have already done. And it's been done for hundreds of years. I mean, buying low, renovating, and selling high is now like this is not rocket science. I did not invent flipping, and either did Natalie. There is just so much information out there about it. As opposed to you have like a new business concept and you're trying to execute on it, and you've got to basically come up with everything. And, you know, you're trying to create a market and you're not sure it's there. We already know the market's there. If we see a renovated sale, we already know there's exits. We already know that if we do this right and the market doesn't substantially change over the time that we own the home, we're going to make money. If you're trying to do, you know, you're trying to get out there with a new venture, and I know you've done this. It's hard. You don't really have this blueprint. You don't have this community of like 600,000 other investors out there who are doing the same thing. I think it's a great entry point, but it is cash intensive, and you know, and it's time intensive. What would you say?
Yeah, I think that it's a good starting point for business, if you like the work that there is, you know, if you're not gonna be, I guess, passionate about, I think passionate about it is the wrong word, because I don't want to imply that we're emotional about any of these houses, because we're not until it's photography day, and then you know, we spend a solid 2 hours in this beautiful finished house that's been finished exactly to our liking. then we get a drop of emotion in it. But that is actually part of the joy of this business as well. So I guess that, yeah, if it's the kind of business that would be right for you to start, would be the kind that you're passionate about and that you get something out of it, other than money.
That's a really good point. I'm biased because I like real estate, so I see it as a good entry point for anything that I want to do later. But the principle is that I actually really like real estate, so I just like to use it that way. But yeah, that's cool. So
hey Grinders, hold up, take a break. We are going over to Jeannie's Grind for a second. We're gonna see what she's thinking about today, and then we'll come back to the interview. Enjoy.
Hey, and welcome back to What's on Jeannie's Grind. Today, I want to share some tips on what you can do when you're feeling stuck in life. I've heard so many people complain about feeling stuck and being unhappy and with no direction in life, but I call BS on these people. Everyone has the ability to have control over their own lives. The decisions you made got you in a situation that makes you unhappy, and you have every opportunity to get yourself in a better situation. The very first thing I would do if you're feeling stuck is to determine what is making you unhappy. And once you identify that source of stress or discontent, you'll be able to determine your game plan for changing it. How easy is that? You know, it's not always that easy to take action, but at the very least, you will have identified the issue and know what needs to change. Then you can create a game plan for how you'll change that thing that makes you unhappy. But the most important thing you need to know is that it will be worth it in the end. Even if it will be a long and tough journey, it will be worth it. Trust me. The next thing you need to do is identify when you're making excuses, because that will deter you from your game plan to happiness and success. Stop with the excuses. You are the only one standing in the way of your own success. Not to mention, if something is wrong, most likely the issue is you. Growth begins from the inside and works itself outwards. Meaning, if you realize you're feeling stuck, you need to determine what you can do in terms of personal growth that will help you get to where you want to be. So work on yourself. Read a book on what you want to be an expert in. Listen to educational podcasts or get a life coach. Do whatever you need to do to improve your personal growth, and you'll see growth in other aspects of your life. So I hope that wasn't too much love for an afternoon. As always, please reach out if you have any questions. Now back to Carson.
All right. That was pretty cool, Jeannie. Let's get back to the show. We're going to hop right into it.
I want to move in the hustle round and ask you guys some questions, just general questions to give our listeners some tips and stuff. Feel free to popcorn this around if one of you wants to answer one and one the other, or you can both answer both, whatever you guys are feeling. You guys ready? You guys need to stretch it out before we hustle?
We're good.
Bring it on.
All right. First question is, what quote or piece of advice is on your mind?
So I have this
I have a couple quotes in my office. One is, just because you cannot see the grass grow does not mean it is not growing. Patience. This is a long marathon. And the other quote that's on my desk, with a giant tiger, angry tiger behind it, is everyone wants to eat, but few are willing to hunt. I think one's a hunter-gatherer, the other's a hunt. but the thing is, like, it's consistent effort. You know, if you want to survive and if you want to thrive in this business, it's day in, day out. I treat it like a job. Natalie treats it like a second job. You know, it's consistent work. I mean, the paydays might be, you know, timed a little differently than they are when you have a regular job. But, you know, we get up every morning and we work through it, and we don't expect to win them all, but it's a numbers game, and you're just consistently chugging along. You're going to be fine. It's that thing we talked about earlier, where you've gotta look at deals every single day if you expect to buy one. That's just what it takes.
Yeah, and I think that establishing business processes also helps with the discipline, with the daily discipline. So establishing a process where, you know, in the morning, first thing in the morning, well, I'm not going to talk about what you do every day in the morning, Eugene, but I mean, just having, building out all of our, like, software systems and just our check-in systems and all of that, and having all that flushed out, which you're not going to have at first. You build as you go. You know, you're building the airplane as you're flying it. But that definitely helps with that daily discipline as well.
Awesome. Awesome. What recent accomplishment are you most proud of? as a team.
You know, I mean, I think we just celebrated our second year of marriage. I think, like, you know, I mean, none of this is really possible if we don't like each other anymore.
That's true. Continuing to like each other every day is an accomplishment.
Great advice.
Maybe not every day, but I think I see partnerships fall apart, and I see people, you know, kind of, you know, to think that the most important thing is what's going on today as far as your business, and, you know, 3 months from now, we're not going to own any of these houses, knock on wood. But, you know, two of us are still going to be together. Try, you know, if there's something, you know, it's keeping it together and, you know, and moving forward. That's what's important. I think it's very easy to get lost in the minutia. And most of it isn't going to matter. You know, 6 months from now, it's going to matter is, you know, Natalie can still put up with me.
Yeah, and I think that part of what helps that is that we make sure that we celebrate the wins, I guess. So, you know, if we just bought a house at a great price, you know, we'll celebrate that. You know, every time we have a closing on a flip, we make sure and celebrate those moments. And it's not like they last very long, usually just a night. And then it's back to that daily discipline. But that's important. That's important to celebrate those times when they come, because the rest of it is a lot of work.
And then not to get too beat up or hard on yourself when you make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. You just are. Let them go. They're going to cost money. When you're dealing with anything that's as expensive as a house, you're going to make mistakes that cost a lot of money, and it's very easy to get down on yourself and get a little depressed. You just got to keep going. That's just all it is. But we like to celebrate the wins because, you know, that's all we're doing. So, you know, but also, finally, the last thing, it's really fun to celebrate growth and, like, celebrate that, like, you're somewhere that's completely different than you were 3 months ago or six mm-hmm. months ago. So,
I like doing that too. Celebrating growth and your wins, even if it's a small win. I used to ask this question, like, what's a recent accomplishment, big or small, that you're most proud of? Because even, like, the small things, like, if you are only looking for the big accomplishments, then it's easier to, like, get down and just be hard-pressed on yourself. But just celebrating a small thing, like, even if it's that you found a deal and you're just really excited about it and you hit like some quota or something, or you trained your dog a new trick or something, like something small. It's just fun to cherish small accomplishments too. We get caught up in like big accomplishments a lot of times, I think, in our society. But small ones are equally fun. What's an activity that you guys have learned the most from in your flipping business?
Walking through houses. I think we touched on this earlier, whether we're evaluating a deal or just learning from what somebody else has done. This is probably what I would say.
We're curious. We're very curious. We see an open house, there's a 9 in 10 chance we're going to walk in. You know, curiosity makes you a lot of money in this business. and having having interest in knowing a little more than the next guy, it has done really well for us. We want to, like, somebody does something really cool, we want to know about it. I mean, that's why you have this podcast. I mean, you're curious. And I'm sure it's going to do very well for you to have that curiosity and ask questions. I like to talk a lot, but you don't learn as much when you talk as you do when you listen. So, sorry if everybody's been listening to me.
Everyone's going to learn some really sound stuff from both of you. So that's awesome. What is your favorite Google Chrome extension?
Pinterest. It's kind of cheesy, but I guess probably Pinterest, because I'm kind of always looking for inspiration for how our houses are going to look and trying to keep tabs on, I don't know, just like what's popular and what people like out there. So yeah, I pin a lot of things.
Nice. Well, I think that's a very practical Chrome extension for someone that flips houses. Who's an influencer or book that you guys have been obsessing about recently? If you guys have different ones, that's cool. I'd love to hear both.
Oh man, that's really hard. So the one thing I'll come back to is that I think Charles Wiki, the growth mindset. There's basics that I think everybody has to read, like The E-Myth. And obviously, like Rich Dad Poor Dad, not the seminar, it's the 75-cent book on Amazon. and you have to get there. I really liked Flip by Nick Ruiz. It's a very simple and practical guide to wholesaling that really breaks it down. I think it's great for intro for investors trying to get into this and trying to get into wholesaling. I think that's a start. Sorry, did you ask for a whole library?
No, that's great. I mean, those are all good resources.
The one thing I would tell was there's subscriptions out there like Scribd, Scribd, or Audible for audiobooks. Audiobooks have really, because we spend so much time on the road looking at houses, you can really use a lot of that time with podcasts. You can really maximize that time and really fly through books. If you tell me you haven't read anything this summer, I'm judging you. Just so we're clear, because there's no excuse.
You know what I just read recently? It was The Prince by Machiavelli.
How was
it? It was like, it was really, I liked it a lot. It was surprisingly business oriented. My government teacher assigned it to us. We're reading like 8 books this semester for that class, but it's all about like politics back then in 1500 or whatever. But it was just like one of the best business books I've ever read. He just has some really good ideas in there. Like besides the part about cutting people's heads off, like if you take what he's saying and just apply it to today's world and not the world of 1500 when people were actually cutting heads off, then it's really, really good advice on just like managing situations and.
It's a very cutthroat viewpoint of the world, though.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But it's like the 40 Laws of Power. Like, that book's kind of creepy because it tells you how to like rule people. But what I get out of it more than understanding some of the good parts is like that you have to understand that some people use those things for evil and that you have to watch out for those people. So it's a good reminder that like, okay, someone might actually use this like against me, and if they're gonna act like this, then you can kind of have red flags that you could look out for. So
I think that a good book to balance out the two of those would be this book called Difficult Conversations. It was have you read this book?
No, I haven't.
It's a product of the Harvard Negotiation Project, I think is the name of the center that produced this. Anyways, it's about personal conflict in any number of settings, you know, between your family and friends relationships, between you and people in the workplace, perhaps between you and a contractor, just how to manage conflict, essentially. And we have conflict all the time, whether it's like slow simmering, whether it has just exploded. And so it's kind of like a handbook for relationships. And since real estate is such a relationship-driven business, I think that it's actually a really important book. And I think that it can help you maybe get to a lot of places that you maybe, or it will present you with a number of tools that maybe you didn't think about being important to have in your toolbox when dealing with business things and all of that.
That sounds like a really good book. I'm definitely going to check that out. I've been interested in that kind of stuff lately. Cool. So we're done with the hustle round. You guys can take a break, drink some Gatorade or something if you need. I want to move into the weekly call out where we have a weekly call out segment every week where we ask guests to call someone out that would be a good grinder to have on the show, someone that's hustling and grinding and might have some good insight to give our listeners. Who would you guys call out?
Brandon Hall, the real estate CPA and also our CPA, spent a long time working for a big four accounting firm and is now, you know, going out there on his own and then making it happen. I think right now would be a very interesting time to talk to the guy because it's happening. It's live. You know, he's been operating in two worlds for a little while, and now he's putting his money where his mouth is, and he's really building out this business. And the other thing I'd say is, he's also a real estate investor, and it's so rare to talk to a CPA. Who's also a real estate investor. He also produces a massive amount of content. I don't know when he does it. I don't know if he doesn't sleep. I would definitely talk to Brandon and see if that's something he would do with you guys.
Awesome. Yeah, I didn't know that he had jumped out on his own and was doing that full time.
Yeah, about a week ago. So get him now.
Get him while it's hot.
Yeah.
That's perfect. I'm definitely going to reach out to him. Cool. Well, what message do you have for the grinders out there?
Consistency, guys. Something that's really interesting is I have a lot of investors approach me or people who are starting out and they're saying, do you think I should do this or do you think I should do that? And they're really thrown back when I say it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because, like, most of what they're pointing to are tried and true strategies, and they're trying to figure out which one it has a higher probability of success. And I really can't answer that question because who knows? I don't know how they're going to apply it. But I do know that if they go from strategy to strategy to strategy, and they don't consistently, you know, execute on one thing, and they get better at that one thing, they're never getting anywhere. And that's, you know, burnout rate in this industry is so high. And part of it is because people try a million things and really they just need to be consistently, you know, consistently doing this one thing and it's going to produce. And that's, you know, if you want to read a book about consistency, it's The One Thing by Gary Keller. It's like 20 minutes of reading and, I'd really recommend consistency. Can I say consistency one more time? Consistency.
Consistently be consistent.
What about you?
That's great.
I think you summed it up well. Be consistent.
Be consistent.
I'm going to be consistent with you in saying that people should be consistent.
Okay. We just got really pro with you, didn't we?
Nice. Well, there's no niche thing in this podcast other than like, you know, young people starting out and doing really cool stuff. So that's like the one thing I like. It might be not good for like business reasons to not have a consistent message, but like everyone's going to have a different voice. So you guys might have this like bigger pocketsy type voice because you're talking about real estate investing, but you're going to sound so different than every other guest, and every other guest is going to sound so different that hopefully people get value out of just listening to different perspectives and finding cool things from like applying it from the real estate business to helping them start their business that's like selling muffins or something, like anything, you know.
Yep.
That's what's fun. So
we're excited to listen to. And that's, you've had some pretty interesting guests from what we gather. So we're pretty excited. We'll be listening to your podcast, and I think one thing I'll add is that I've watched you work over the last 6 months, and I've watched you just consistently like hit your head against the wall until it worked. And like I think it's just so cool. I've seen some of like your transactional work and some of the things you've done in recruiting, and like that work ethic. You know, if there's something that I would look at and see, oh, this guy's going to be successful, this guy's not going to make it, it's work ethic, and you've got it, Carson. And I'm impressed.
Ah, well, thanks, Eugene. That means a lot. I really appreciate that. And I've certainly come across things in the podcast. I think we've gone through 10 software programs. Where can people follow you if they're like interested in seeing your flips and stuff?
Let us get back to you on that one. What do you want?
We have not. The one thing we've not been very consistent about is documenting all of this for followers. But that's one thing that's on our to-do list.
Yeah, I am a broker at Customer Realty. So customerrealty.com. You can reach out to them with Eugene Davidson at customerrealty.com. You can send me an email. One thing I do with guys who are kind of curious about the business is if you want to spend the day with me and kind of looking and kind of seeing what it looks like, you know, inspecting current projects, looking for new flips, or just like going through one of our current and progress projects, kind of see what it looks like. I'm doing that with three guys tomorrow. We met at the last RIA meeting we went to. And so then the reason for that is I want people to see legitimacy. There's a lot of pretenders in the business who aren't really doing deals. And so we're pretty transparent, and if somebody wants to see what these projects look like, if they want to come out a couple of times and see them from beginning to end, we're always open. So you can just always drop me an email and say. And the other thing is we've had a lot of investors who have helped us out of tight spots and who have mentored us. I'll always pick up the phone, and so will Natalie if somebody calls us with a question. And then we're available, and we're not charging anybody hourly. If you're looking for a referral, we might be able to point you in the right direction. It's just part of paying back the enormous amount of time that other people have spent with us.
That's awesome. Well, that's really golden for anyone. Anyone that's in the DC area that's interested in flipping, definitely take up that opportunity. I mean, you could learn a lot from Eugene and Natalie on anything within real estate, not just flipping. So that's cool. Well, I really appreciate you guys being on the show. I know you have a lot going on and everything, and it's been fun to talk to you and catch up a little bit about your flipping business. And I'm excited to see where it goes and how some of your current flips turn out. And I'll definitely be keeping an eye on the MLS and seeing how they go.
All right. Thanks, Carson.
Thanks.
All right. I appreciate it, guys.
All right, Grinders. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. If you learned at least one thing, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. We would love to hear from you. Reach out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, LinkedIn. Check us out and let us know what you're up to. Until then, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you soon.